for those of us raised on the Western story of history, what do you think is the biggest single thing that we've gotten wrong?
One is how recent the ascendancy of the West is.
Uh-huh.
The great cradles of civilization are the Nile, Mesopotamia, the Tigris and the Euphrates in what's now Iraq, the Yangtze River in what's now China, and the Indus Valley. And most people will think about those places and go, I'm sure those were important once upon a time, but they're not important now. The United States today is the Roman Empire of the past, but it's quite a new arrival onto the stage. So I think the rhythms of history about how do places rise and fall, what's coming next, looked at over 2,000 or 3,000 years, that bit where the western side of Europe built these great global empires was an anomaly. And maybe that era has also finished. So it feels to me that we're living through an age of great geopolitical change. India and China, the two largest, most populous countries on Earth, the Gulf, Iran, the Middle East, how Russia fits into the global family of nations. These worlds that seem exotic and not that relevant,
right.
How they see their past is that this is history and the clock being reset back to how things used to look.
Welcome to Socrates in the Studio, which falls under the aegis of Socrates in the City. The city in which we find ourselves today is, as I'm told, London, England. It's my privilege today to have as my guest the author of this big book. His name is Peter Frankopan. The book is The Silk Roads, A New History of the World. How's that for an outrageous subtitle? How dare he say that? If he weren't here, I would have many terrible things to say about it, but he's sitting here right here in the room. Let me say more about Peter Frankopan before we get into it. He's professor of global history at Oxford University and director of the Oxford Center for Byzantine Research. He's an historian of the connections between East and West, has spent his career on the Mediterranean, Persia, Russia, Central Asia, and the long entanglement of Christianity and Islam. His books include The First Crusade, The New Silk Roads, and The Earth Transformed, but he's best known for the book I have here, The Silk Roads, an international bestseller translated into dozens of languages, perhaps scores, that reshaped how a generation of readers sees world history. Peter Frankopan, welcome.
Thank you for having me. Pleasure to be here.
There's so much I want to ask you about, but let's just start with the title, The Silk Roads, A New History of the World. As an author who has authored many titles and subtitles, that is a big subtitle, A New History of the World. So what would give you permission? How do you give yourself permission to say something as dramatic as that, A New History of the World?
Can anybody listening to this podcast, can you tell me the name of any philosopher that's not European or from the Western tradition, of any artist, contemporary, or the most important poet in the Arab world over the last 1,500 years?
Yeah.
A single Chinese emperor?
Yeah.
Most people, the answer is no. So when we think about history in the West, in Europe, we start with Athens and Rome.
Yeah.
We then have a 1,000-year gap that used to be called the Dark Ages. Historians argue about what we should call it instead. Then we pick up here in England with the Norman Conquest. You guys hear about that. Then we get to the king with lots of wives, and then we head up towards American independence, and it all looks like a nice continuous story of you look at the Jefferson Memorial, look at the Lincoln Memorial, look at the White House. These are classical buildings from the Mediterranean that have popped up in North America, and that's what history looks like. It's about how the West looks. And I'm not here to tell you that is wrong, but if you take as a starting point other cultures, other histories, other civilizations, I'm not just here to tell you they're interesting in their own right. Why should we know about other parts of the world? All of our worlds are born and connect to them in the first place. So it's a simple example quite early on in my book, Alexander the Great. You know, I know you've got some strong Greek connections.
Yes.
The most important, the most famous Greek military hero of all time, whose fame is celebrated around the world. It didn't cross his mind when he decided to build a great empire as a young, ambitious man, to head towards the hills of Tuscany, or towards Rome, or towards France, or towards London.
Or Virginia or Massachusetts.
Right. For him, the peer group that he was competitive with and all of Greek culture is about facing east towards Persia.
Yeah.
The Odyssey, the Iliad, these great cities of that dominate the Greek epic tradition come from connections with the Eastern Mediterranean and then further eastwards. And then when you start to then think about the world of the past, you start to ask slightly different questions. So, for example, all of our major global religions are all born in Asia. You know, we don't think about that because we have there's a Pope in Rome and there's a Orthodox Archbishop Patriarch in wherever it is, Constantinople. We think about the Latin Rite, but Jesus Christ didn't speak a European language. He spoke Aramaic. This was, you know, he was born in Bethlehem in what's now the Middle East. Buddhism, Islam, Hinduism, Jainism, you know, the list keeps going, are all born in Asia, and they spread in different kinds of ways, in ways which we don't expect. So you have Christian bishops and archbishops right across Central Asia, in places like Kashgar and what's now China, hundreds of years before you get them in most parts of Europe. And I think because we have lived in this last 250 years of American supremacy and the Western age, we shut the door on other people's histories. And that's not helpful when we're trying to make sense of other parts of the world. And, you know, today there are more people who live in Asia than all the other continents combined. You know, it's about 80% of the world's food supply is grown in Asia, rice and wheat. 70% of the energy supplies. You and the US are quite well supplied with both, but most other parts aren't. So I think the new history of the world is trying to join regions and periods together. It's trying to use new materials in lots of different languages that are technically quite difficult to learn how to study and how to use. And it's about joining up multiple regions to explain how things came into being.
How did you get into this? In other words, what is your origin story? Was this something you were interested in as a young person? What is your story?
I was interested in why people wanted to kill me. I'm a child of the Cold War. My childhood was dominated by the Soviet Union in a standoff with the United States and the West that was guaranteed in my lifetime, how I was brought, my generation, but our generation was brought up, that there would be likely a nuclear war. We'd hope it would be small. We hope it wouldn't be global. But there was a realistic chance that we would live through nuclear winter and the complete destruction of civilizations we knew it. There'll be lucky survivors through nuclear war. So I wanted to understand, in first instance, the Soviet Union, Russia, why it was at odds with the way of living that seemed so obviously right to me, freedoms and institutions and the ability to say and think what you liked.
Although that wasn't so much Russia as it was communism. In other words, those are two issues, though, aren't there?
Well, it wasn't Russia, actually. It was the Soviet Union. So that's 15 constituent republics.
So it wasn't Russia. It was the Soviet Union. Exactly.
Well, it's not as simple as that, because communism is not just about taking on the West. The whole principles of communism in classical Marxist ideology is that there's a world revolution where the global proletariat takes over. Mm. So it's about a system that is seeking the overthrow of another. So that was one reason. I grew up at a time of profound dislocation in the Middle East with the struggles for freedoms in Palestine, in Gaza, in Israel, likewise Lebanon, parts of the world that have been resonant for decades, hundreds of years. I grew up at a time of genocide in Cambodia, where half the population of that country were killed by Pol Pot and his regime, and just at the tail end of the Vietnam War. So I was 5 or 6 years old, but the consequences of the spillover of that war went on and on until 1979, China invaded Vietnam. And so the world that I could see in the news every day of overthrow revolution in Iran in 1979, the sieges of the mosques in Mecca in 1979, these were places I didn't hear about in my classroom. So I'd watch the news and I'd see Iran, Soviet Union and Russia, the East, coups everywhere, genocide, suffering. And I wanted to understand how these people fitted into my story, because I knew that we were involved in some of that. And yet my lessons in my history class were all about, you know, Tudors and Stuarts, the First World War, the Second World War, things that were local with global consequences. But no one explained why these societies mattered. So I was lucky to go to a school where I had a Russian teacher, and even luckier that he was the kind of teacher that probably schools would hesitate to employ today, because he'd been in naval intelligence. He'd been trained to debrief defecting Soviet sailors, of whom there were not very many. And so he was incredibly interesting. So to talk to him, we all wanted to talk to him about how he'd been trained and what he would do if he found someone. And he wanted us to understand the world. So he would sing to us Russian songs, which wasn't the traditional way to pass your exams. But he would say, boys, I was at a little boys' school, if you want to understand people's culture, go and stand outside the bars at closing time and listen to what people are saying and listen to what they're singing. And that was an extremely enlightened thing to hear as a 16, 17-year-old boy. And as it happened, he'd also gone and learnt Arabic and came back and taught some of us Arabic in a year, age 17. So by the time I went to university, I was already looking at these connected worlds and thinking about how the global jigsaw fitted together rather than the bit that everybody else mm-hmm. spent their time looking at.
And what are the Silk Roads? That's the title, of course, of the book. What are the Silk Roads, or what do you mean by the Silk Roads when you say that?
So the Silk Roads is an abstract term. There's no sort of set of motorways. There's no right. place that is on it or isn't on it.
Right.
The idea about the Silk Roads is coined first by a Roman author almost 2,000 years ago that talks about things coming from long distance, luxuries, things like silks that are mm-hmm. made from cocoons of silkworms, extremely valuable. Not all the Romans are very happy about that, by the way. People like Seneca, who's a kind of purist, says that it's disgraceful that the curves of their bodies should be seen under this light material. But if you spend time in the Mediterranean, as I know you do, silk is a very light fabric. It's very breathable. It's a very nice thing to wear mm-hmm. if you're hot. But it was used by authors like Ammianus Marcellinus to explain that there is long distances away where people we don't know that much about are sending stuff through caravans and overseas to come and reach us. And in the 19th century, the idea of the Silk Roads becomes more and more popular as a way of thinking about, in particular, how India, Central Asia and China are connected through things like the spread of Buddhism and of languages. But at the beginning of the 20th century, it gets really pushed by the culture of Japan. Japan is the first ever state in Asia that is able to defeat a European enemy. In 1904-5, the Russians send the Imperial Navy to come and fight the Japanese and they get sunk. And Japan and Japanese scholars start to think, how do we tell our story about interconnected regions of Asia, of mathematics, of philosophy, of optics, of science, of medicine, of literatures, that allow us to show our dignity so we don't just hear about the greatness of the European traditions? And the Silk Roads got used and becomes popular as a way of saying these are Asian societies that connect regionally, locally, and intercontinentally, through trade networks, through the spreads of language, through pilgrimage, through devotion, through knowledge, and a way of thinking about the ways in which networks of the past have got together. And in the Arab tradition, there are books that are all written about the webs and connections of roads. Roads is a very good metaphor to explain how the multiplicity of east, west, north, south, and why it is that people travel for profit, for learning, for knowledge, for adventure. And so it has a certain romance to it. But like all labels, it's clumsy. Like Europe is a clumsy label, you know, where it starts and stops. Asia, is there really something in common between people living in Korea and the Gulf or in Turkey? But it's a way of capturing multiple levels of different kinds of exchange to show that these connections are ways in which societies in the past have linked together.
Why do you think it seems that a large part of your thesis, the reason for writing the book is that, you're arguing that the lands between the East and the West have always been where the action is, or where most of the action is, where religions, goods, ideas, armies collide. Why do you think the West has been so blind to that, such that it would need a book like this? You know, what is it about the West, or is that an assumption that I'm making?
I think if you're on the right side, if you win at history, if you're dominant politically, economically, you tend to be dominant culturally. So you write and cherry pick the histories that you want. Mm. So in the British tradition, we lean very heavily on ancient Greece and the classical world of Rome. We have a slightly different interpretation of the Roman Empire to how you guys in the United States did it. And, you know, I know because you've done so well writing about the U.S. Declaration of Independence, the Founding Fathers were obsessed about the model of Republican Rome and not Imperial Rome.
Right.
Right. And that is a nuance that is unusual for us here in Europe because we have hereditary monarchies. We have aristocracies that don't have a problem about the Republican tradition. We tend to think about things in slightly different ways. But it meant that the bits in the middle between where Rome declined from about the year 400 or so after the sack by the Goths and the Avars, those next 1,200 years are difficult to talk about because that's why in your school curriculums after the Romans, there's this long gap, right? Because there's nothing really to celebrate. But in those moments, in those histories, you find the greatest interpreters of Aristotle are based in cities like Bukhara in what's now Uzbekistan, a man called Ibn Sina, who we know here as Avicenna. All the most pioneering work on optics, on astronomy, on medicine, on science are all taking place in big cities, not because their cultures are dominant, but because cities bring people together. And if you bring people together, there are high tax takes, like New York City, and then you can spend on monumental architecture, you can spend on sciences, you have rich people who want to buy the best product. So I think that at this time, let's say 1,000 years ago, the year 1,000, cities like Merv in Turkmenistan, which I guess most people would never heard of, was the largest inhabited city on Earth for about 500 years.
When I read that first of all, that there's a city named Merv was new to me. The mere name of the city.
Right, Merv is an uncle in upstate New York.
Merv is a talk show host from the 1970s who was on early enough that I was able to watch him, even though I was very young. But the idea that there was a city named Merv, where?
It's in what's now Turkmenistan, so north of Iran, south of Russia. A population of somewhere touching 800,000, maybe more. Baghdad, 1 million. Kaifeng, Xi'an. These cities are enormous. And to give that sense of scale, around the same time, places that we're more familiar with, Paris, London, Rome, are maybe 10, 15,000. And, you know, so these cities are not just big to make cities work, whether it's New York City or London. You need to have infrastructure. You need to have city officials who know how to plan streets and sewage and sanitation. You need to work out how you get food in to feed these people every day. So those periods get left out because we're not really important in Europe in that part of history. And the place that is important is Venice. And Venice is the kind of gateway of Europe to the East. And you know, Venice connected through the Adriatic Sea to the Middle East and beyond. The question is, what is it we in Europe can be selling to other parts of the world that other people want? Because here in Europe, despite what President Trump has tended to say, we've got lots of oil under the North Sea. We have very little that people would want. We don't have gold mines in Europe, really. There's not much silver. Our metals, we've got a bit of. But if you're looking at how God has distributed wealth and natural resources, you could do a lot worse in the United States and North America, which is blessed with abundance of all kinds. Europe doesn't look like that. So in Europe, we had to think quite hard about what to sell. And the primary product that we could sell in large quantities in Europe as we came out of the Dark Ages were men and women. And so when you go to Italy and you order a cappuccino and you say ciao, you're actually saying schiavo, which means I'm your slave. So places like Venice, Dublin, Utrecht, these great cities start to rise 1,000 years ago as slave trading centres and sending thousands of, if not tens and hundreds of thousands of people into markets further beyond. So why do we not know about these parts of the world? Because we're not part of their stories, and it's awkward to explain that we are living in the sticks, in the mud, without building in stone, really. We don't produce any great scholarship, no writing, no musical traditions. We become that Dark Ages. That starts to change around about 1200, 1300, but the big jackpot point comes when Columbus crosses the Atlantic. And again, your listeners and viewers will know that Columbus wasn't trying to explore. He wasn't trying to see if the world was flat, which we'd known for 5,000 years it wasn't. Columbus was trying to find ways to get to India and China, because those were where the big markets were.
Right.
And Columbus knew that, and he thought if he could connect what became Spain to India and China, he could make so much money that he could help lead a crusade that would capture Jerusalem from the Muslims. So this world has always been thinking about how things face towards the worlds that I work on. And even here with a very distinguished American historian, the set piece at Boston Harbor, the Tea Party, is all about the Silk Roads.
Oh,
it's
yeah.
about tea that's grown in China, dropped in East India Company chests, packed in India, into a harbour because of the prices of being thought to be too high, the tax system's changing, by people dressed as Indians, all about how the United States sees itself relative to other parts of the British Empire, including in the East. And so these rhythms are there everywhere. But history can be like being a doctor. You sometimes, you know, we always look at the surface of the skin.
Mm-hmm.
A good doctor, like a good historian, this is a Greek analogy and an Arabic analogy, you need to look at the organs, you need to look at the veins, the arteries underneath the skin. And to do that, you need a bit of precision, you need some skill, and you need to be curious.
Well, so for those of us raised on the Western story of history, what do you think is the biggest mistake or the biggest single thing that we've gotten wrong about how we got here, you know?
Well, so one is how recent the ascendancy of the West is, right? So if you go back even further than I do in Silk Roads, and you think about the first cities in the world, there's a bit of Mesoamerica, right, in what's now Mexico, in the Valley of Mexico. But the great cradles of civilization are the Nile, Mesopotamia, the Tigris and the Euphrates in what's now Iraq, the Yellow River and the Yangtze River in what's now China, and the Indus Valley. And most people will think about those places and go, I'm sure those were important once upon a time, but they're not important now. That cycle of change about how places rise and fall, you know, the United States today is the Roman Empire of the past, but it wasn't always like that, right? It's quite a new arrival onto the stage. So I think the rhythms of history about how do places rise and fall, what's coming next, is London a place in decline, for example? Or is Europe a place in decline? Did we have our moment in the sunshine? But looked at over 2,000 or 3,000 years, that bit where the western side of Europe, particularly Britain, Spain, Portugal, France, built these great global empires, was an anomaly and it was unusual. And maybe that era has also finished. So it feels to me that we're living through an age of great geopolitical change where the regalvanization of all networks is on the move. So how India and China, the two largest, most populous countries on Earth, between them about 40% of the world's population, how they connect with each other, how Russia fits into the global family of nations, if it even does or ever will again, how the Gulf, Iran, the Middle East, all these pieces of the puzzle are on the move. And in the way in the world we were brought up in, we paid a lot of attention to the Netherlands or to Canada and to Spain and Portugal, but those don't feel to me that those offer existential challenges or existential opportunities. And these worlds that seem exotic and not that relevant, how they see their past is that this is history and the clock being reset back to how things used to look.
One of the things that I can't help think, because talking about civilizations is such a huge subject. I mean, it's what you do. But the idea is that civilizations, my idea is that civilizations rise and fall on what they hold most sacred. And that there's a reason that those of us in the West who value the West, which isn't everyone, have an idea that there are ideas, really biblical ideas, Christian ideas about liberty, the sanctity of the individual, that are important and are different and in some ways better than ideas that would say, no, we don't agree with that, and that the rise of what we would call Western civilization is mainly because of that. Am I wrong about that? Because that's I want to be clear. In other words, I'm not sure what your thesis is.
I don't think that you're wrong. I mean, those Christian traditions don't just pop out of the blue. You know, there's a long tradition about where these ideas come from and how they develop over time. So Christianity, we today associate with freedoms, but at the time, the Romans found this extremely aggressively threatening. And that's why you have persecutions by people like Diocletian, who threw thousands of Christians to the lions. So yes, freedoms are very threatening to political powers.
Yeah.
And in fact, even in today's world, although it's true all of us believe in freedoms, we know that when pushed, those become a bit more tricky. So freedoms mean as long as we all get on okay, but it's not okay. I mean, some people have different views about tolerances of religions in the United States, for example, that they're comfortable with Judeo-Christians, but perhaps not with other traditions. And so how you integrate that, say we believe in flatline freedoms and where those exist, but there's a whole family of architecture of what democracy means that look different in different places. So you've got a presidential system in the US where the president can appoint anybody into whichever position he or she wants, and can use executive orders to go through Congress and so on, that which looks very different, doesn't mean make it better or worse, but looks very different to our system here in the UK, which is in turn very different to the French system, very different to elsewise. And yet in other societies, tolerances look, to me, although at institutional level, autocratic systems can be worrying. We shouldn't forget that it was here in Europe, the cradle of civilization, I guess, that the Holocaust took place. you know, we shouldn't forget that it's here in Europe that 20 million men were sent to their deaths by the British and the German empires fighting each other in the First World War over security of Europe in a very abstract sense. And so freedoms, they mean something if you're writing the history.
Well, you're saying a number of things at once. I don't want to get lost here.
Yeah.
When you bring up the Holocaust, for example, it seems to me that the Holocaust was let's put it this way. If we're talking about the West, would you think of the Holocaust as something that grows out?
I think anti-Semitism is endemic in Western societies. So if you talk about freedoms and tolerance, then you've got some awkward conversations to say, do you really mean freedoms? If you talk about freedoms of the West, you've got to be honest about what that means for people of different skin color. For example, in the United States, when Thomas Jefferson, that beautiful introduction of the Declaration of Independence, yeah, talking about how God, the Creator, has made all men equal, that doesn't mean all men. That means white men. It also means in Western traditions where women aren't allowed to vote. Women in places like Uzbekistan and Azerbaijan were allowed to vote before they were in the United Kingdom. So that idea about how we retrofit freedoms to make ourselves feel good. So here in the West, we talk about the glories of Western, which I'm absolutely all on side with, of Mozart, of Picasso, of Leonardo da Vinci, of Aristotle. But you've got to mark the negative column on that as well, of suffering, of persecution, of anti-Semitism, of course, of which the Holocaust is the apotheosis of the kind of nadir of human suffering.
But murdering millions of people in a genocide is really not consonant with biblical values. So I think we have to be careful as we're talking about the West. What do we mean by the West? I mean, the wheat and the tares grow up together. So clearly, a world of anti-Semitism that leaps to genocide is not something that I think most people in the West would say that follows from our views. I would hope that most people would say, well,
No one wants to hear the negatives. In the same way, no one wants to hear about the persecution of minorities. No one wants to hear about the horrors of the slave trade. And because this is a very much more resonant discussion, I think, in the United States, even than it is here in the UK, I think it's the acknowledgement that societies get built on blood and sweat of many, and it's who takes those benefits.
Because I've just written the book on the Revolution, I wouldn't have known this on the American Revolution. I was astonished to see how dramatically anti-slavery many Americans were at the time.
Correct.
Obviously, in order to unite against King George III, compromises were made, but they weren't made joyfully. It was an ugly thing to many of them. And when I think of John Adams and Samuel Adams and others, mostly in the Massachusetts Bay Colony, who came out of this Puritan tradition, this strong Christian tradition, they despised the idea of slavery, and they despised the idea that there were people willing to sign the Declaration of Independence who did not see the phrase "all men are created equal" as meaning all men.
Correct.
So I think we have to be clear that hypocrisy is hypocrisy. Not everybody is on board with hypocrisy.
No, but by and large, in the case of the United States, the further north your colony was, the more hostile you were to slavery because you had less exposure to slavery, less benefits.
You're making a leap. I just want to say that you're making it seem that self-interest is the rule. Isn't it possible that the people in the northern colonies were hostile to slavery because they had they were morally repulsed by it?
Yes. And the truth is, the decision to leave Great Britain produced the greatest empire so far we've seen in the world, right? And it took 70, 80 years afterwards for slavery to become abolished. So there's a long burn. It's how much you can achieve in one go. And those voices that had been hostile to slavery, it took a long time, it took a civil war for that side of the argument to win. And you're absolutely right. the fact that you win that side of history means that you can talk about your values over those that you've washed over and taken and defeated. But I think, as in other parts of the world, it's about where those histories get written and when they're written. And I think that in other parts of the world too, where slavery hasn't been addressed, for example, so you have 7 or 8 million slaves taken out of Africa that go to the Ottoman world, and slaves taken from Central Asia to feed the Middle East. And most people don't know about that. We think about transatlantic slaveries. But then the right question should be asking is, how do empires get built on the blood and the work of people who are enslaved and not given the dignity of being treated equal with others? Mm.
So would you level that criticism against some of the Asian empires that you write about? Because I'm not familiar enough with them even to know. But I assume that there were abolitionist movements in the Islamic world.
Well, it depends where you look and which period and how, but generally finding the lowest possible cost of production is one that's always interests powerful people. Right? In the Soviet Union too, if you can reduce the fact that you need to pay wages and you can pay everybody equally, then your costs of production are low. And that's familiar to any business owner too. So if you can find and create a system of enslavement, then you're going to have high levels of production that generate wealth that goes upwards and is taken over by elites at the top. At some point, there can be a case where the rich are so wealthy that they start to think about manumission. So typically, it's not abolition movements. It's about, on a case-by-case, individual basis, that you free your slaves.
But you're still pegging this on self-interest.
Yes.
So is that part of your... In other words, that strikes me at some point as becoming cynical if it's only about self-interest. Self-interest is part of what makes things rise and fall. There's no question.
Fair enough. There's no question. So let me move. The problem, but when you talk about self-interest, you focus on the individual, right? And I don't have the capacity and capabilities as a historian to judge people's motivations, but I recognize that everybody's motivations are complex. Yeah. Therefore, you get stuck about self-interest, because where self-interest is relative to rewards and kindness and so on is a different story. But let me frame it in a slightly different way. Empires, states, whichever place, whichever time, all have the same pathology, which is the point of an empire is to centralize the delivery of resources to the center, to bring resources from the peripheries and wherever you find them to the center for the benefit of the group, at whether it's the state or the individuals who can control the state. That's how the Roman Empire works. You build this empire, you funnel tax money, you funnel resources, manpower, metals, food, back to the center that then chooses how to distribute it. That is how that's how all states work, all empires. And in that sense, self-interest, of course, sounds cynical, but that's what the functioning of a state does, right? That's all.
Well, there's limits to the concept of self-interest, right? I mean, there's a healthy idea of self-interest, and then there's a place where you are oppressing other people in your self-interest. And so, I would like to think that most of us in the modern West would realize that that there are things that one ought not to do. It's not, in other words, it's not simply that I have the power to do it and I should do it.
And yet we do them. So my shirt that I'm wearing uses 2,500 liters of water to make, right? Because I'm well enough educated and I pay attention to these things, I'm able to make decisions about what I'm willing to pay for things that are going to be more expensive because of the conditions in which they're made. Most of our clothes, our flat screen TVs, our iPhones, whatever piece of kit you have, are normally made in conditions far worse than they would be in an American factory, which is why jobs got moved out of the United States into other parts of the world that ironically made other parts of the world rich and become a threat to the United States.
Right.
That's to do with the equation of what's the right benefit. Is the benefit to the customer, the consumer, the lowest possible cost, or about their self-interest? If their self-interest was properly squared up, you'd keep all the factories in the United States. Yeah. You'd have the environmental and social rights at the highest possible standards, but the goods would be much more expensive.
Right.
So when you say self-interest, people behave in a self-interested way that don't pay much attention to how things get made. Well, they want the cheapest possible price.
But that's why we have these conversations, because people need to be aware of these kinds of things.
Right.
It's why I'm not a radical free market person, because I think there's always a question of who made this thing. Was it made by a slave or somebody who is treated like a slave? And if that's true, I don't want to reward the people who are using the slave labor. And that's a moral question, and we should be asking that question. If I can get something 10 cents cheaper, but I have to, labor, sure. Or I have to use the labor of Uyghur Muslims in China in some kind of a camp, morally, I should be willing to pay more money.
That's right. But, you know, people don't go to poultry farms and see that of the 75 billion chickens raised every year, 20 billion die and don't make it to the dinner table. Right. People recognize that they get their car with gas and they recognize it probably, you know, in the grand scheme can't be doing too much. And yet in London in the summer of 2026, we touch 40 degrees centigrade, which I promise you is unusual. Right. In a country where it rains a lot. So we have to sometimes be protected from our self-interest because our self-interest is damaging and is destructive. And in fact, as it happens, that is one of the most important messages in the Christian tradition in the Bible. And if you remember your Sunday schools, the flood of Noah is about the punishment meted out by God to men for being disobedient and being selfish and self-interested. The Garden of Eden, it's very simple. You've got one rule. Yeah. Don't touch that tree.
Yeah.
You've got everything you need.
Yeah.
All the food, every kind of, you know, you don't need to wear sun factor 50. Everything in this garden is perfect.
Yeah.
Just obey God's rule and don't touch the apple. Yeah. And the punishment that's given out is to teach humans that this is what the consequences are of self-interest.
Yeah.
So that idea about self-interest and humans with original sin being unable to stop themselves from making bad decisions.
Yeah.
The importance of free will in the Christian tradition, and other traditions too, about being able to make mistakes is fundamental to the fact that we're fallible, but that is our fundamental part of us, is that we are self-interested and we are selfish and stupid. And so while I agree with you, when you focus on the individual about self-interest being cynical, there is something that is profoundly important in that recognition that sometimes you need to make societal decisions.
Absolutely.
And that the state needs to stop individuals from doing what's right for them because we need to work what's right for us.
Yeah, I don't think I disagree with that. I mean, I don't like the idea of a powerful state. At the same time, I would like to think that
you come from a country which spends $1 trillion on its defense to have a powerful state that it can project power around the world. So you don't want a powerful state, but you want aircraft carriers. You want a military that keeps you safe from every other threat on Earth. So that involves having a powerful state. So
it depends what we mean by powerful state. And I think we're probably going beyond the conversation if we get into that. When a great civilization declines, there are typically warning signs that show up again and again. Or I should say, do you see in your study of civilizations warning signs for civilizations that decline? What are your thoughts on that, generally speaking? Because you've studied so many civilizations, and I guess then the question where we are today or where the West is today.
Look, I think it's to paraphrase a very famous quote, you know, how do you go bankrupt? You go bankrupt very slowly and then suddenly very quickly. So sometimes there are compression events where the rug gets pulled out from under your feet very fast.
Yeah.
Generally, the kind of the pathology of how things start to go wrong is that you start to struggle about balancing the very simple logistics of your expenditure and your income. So if your economy doesn't grow, if you're not able to innovate, if you're not able to generate enough power, food, water, etc., then things can topple over very fast. So, and sometimes it can be shocks. So, for example, with the great Queen Cleopatra in Egypt, her biggest challenge was that just after Julius Caesar was assassinated in Rome in 44 BC, there's an enormous volcanic eruption in Alaska. And we can tell this with these new tools that we have.
In Alaska.
In Alaska, called Okmok. I'm in the first generation of historians that have access to this data that no one's ever been able to tell before. We know that changed rainfall patterns that compromised the Nile flood. So the Nile, which is this great breadbasket where the flood come up with the rich sediment that produces almost unlimited free food, fails. When you have food compression and you have famine, you have hoarding, people don't like to, they keep more than they need, prices go up, people lose confidence in the state, and suddenly what has looked like an economic superpower over the course of about 9 months reaches a critical point where you reach almost collapse. And Cleopatra does what any smart leader would do. She pins her hopes on Mark Antony, who's famously got the best legs in the Roman Empire. He takes a great deal of time looking after them. But more importantly, he's the darling of the Roman army. So he's a smart bet to build an alliance with. And in fact, leverages that to make territorial gains outside Egypt. So she's super, super smart. Unfortunately, Octavius, or Octavian rather, who's one of the kind of triumvirate who's sent out to avenge Julius Caesar's death, figures that his, like all good politicians, that alliance offers him a way in. He corners Mark Antony and Cleopatra in Alexandria, whether they die through snake bites, suicide, burning, it doesn't really matter. But he then offers himself up to the Egyptian people to say, I will be your ruler now. And Cleopatra's great weakness as ruler is not that she's a woman, it's that she's the descendant of Greek generals. And how the Greeks, how the Ptolemies kept their power within the family is they marry their brothers and sisters to stop having some guy gets a leg up. You know, keep the Trump dynasty going. Don't make an alliance with Elon Musk because otherwise he's going to come and take power from you. And in this particular case, Octavian says, look, I will be your ruler from outside, so you don't have to pick amongst yourselves. That works well. And when he comes back to Rome, the Senate says to him, you have given us unlimited freedom of food forever. Interest rates collapse. Cost of building goes up. Rome starts when he dies. Octavian, who's given the title by the Senate, Augustus, which means you blessed, lucky, beautiful man for giving us this sudden wealth. Mm. When Augustus dies, he writes, and you can see it today in Rome on his tomb, I found the city in brick and I left it in marble. So you can have these moments of sudden change where the delivery of shock can transform everything. In this particular case, you could make the case that Rome inherits Egypt. Is that a good thing if you're Egyptian or a bad thing, or is it neutral? Does it matter whether your emperor sits in Rome or sits astride the pyramids? So in today's world, it's the same equation. Can you pay your own way? Can you provide the architecture of stuff that you need? And in today's world, of course, defence is part of that, but so is the technological infrastructure, data servers, the energy to make it work. Here in Europe, we're not blessed with energy in the same way that you guys are in the US. We could have done better. We do well. You know, my university, for example, we produce Nobel laureates with the rest of them. You know, we have a very proud, fierce intellectual tradition of producing brilliant scientists and historians and writers. But we're going to struggle in the modern world to keep up with the power of the US system. And we're going to struggle to keep up with other rising states like China, which now produces more scientific research papers than the US and the West and Europe combined. And some of those things are about the sheer weight of your punching battle stations. And the US has critical mass that we don't have here. We could get there in Europe, I suppose, if we work together. And, you know, Trump, J.D. Vance, love them or hate them, are asking the right question of where are you in Europe? Are you at the races? Are you able to seize your destiny? Or are you going to become part of a new Dark Ages where you're a nice city to go and visit, and people come to our British museums and visit Venice and go, wow, this feels like a place that was once wealthy and important. Or can you keep your skin in the game? And in the world of rising empires, I would, as well as seeing the United States, China on the move, India, etc., you know, Gulf states before the Iran war happened, with the resources they have, you could start to think about how corporations are behaving as semi-autonomous, multinational entities that will compete with the state, right? And some of the biggest companies in the US, the size that they have means they are national security sensitive, but also the decisions they make, who they're allowed to sell the microchips to, who gets to collect their data, suddenly becomes something that their shareholders and their business owners and the people who run the business, their interests are not aligned with what the government of Washington wants. So I for sure, in the coming years and decades, it'll be the question of can you regulate these kinds of powers? Should the state in the United States be able to lean into Apple, Meta, Google, these massive, massive companies? And again, what we've seen the last couple of years is very unusual. You want a small state, but we've seen this administration take a stake in Intel, to take critical stakes in minerals that are going to be required for US infrastructure. And the state is leaning into more and more and more things. Mm-hmm. And that makes a lot of Americans very uncomfortable, because most people want their state to be involved in as little as possible. But without that coordination, you know, you can see what happened to us here in Europe. And we were preparing for the wrong exam question at the wrong time. Mm-hmm. And now it's, can we get the cardiac arrest treatment to get us back into the game in time? But that is exactly what happened when Rome fell. Western Europe couldn't answer those questions, couldn't work out how to cooperate, couldn't work out what our resources were. And it took us literally 1,000 years to go from the sack of Rome in 410. You know, maybe I'll give you the 1200s. But, you know, the 13, 1400s, then you get Dante, you get Petrarch, you get Boccaccio, you get Leonardo da Vinci. But it's a long, long spell in the waiting room.
Well, you're mentioning individuals. How is Dante necessarily related to the world in which he emerges.
Well, it's a product of wealth, right? So you need patronage for artists, right? That's one. So you've got to have an economic model that balances. Right. You've got to have rich merchants who go, I want a palace.
If people don't have food, they're not going to be writing in Tertiary Rima.
You need critical mass. You need institutions. You need cities that work. You need to have a military capability that goes and secures what you need at the expense of others. And it takes a long time for that to happen. And ironically, because, you know, again, we mentioned Greece a few times, the single entity in Europe that works best is the one that is the most obscure to most people, is the Byzantine Empire, which is the Roman Empire by another name in the East that goes for 1,000 years, understands inflation, understands coinage, understands macroeconomics, understands foreign policy, understands stability. It's the only empire in human history that lasts for more than 1,000 years. And yet, if you were to read a book about the history of Europe, you will not find the word Byzantine anywhere. And in fact, when we use the word Byzantine, we tend to use it negatively, pejoratively.
I was going to say, when I was reading your bio, when I say that you're director of the Oxford Center for Byzantine Research, it almost sounds like a joke, right? That, Byzantine research, meaning obscure, difficult.
There is history in a nutshell.
Yeah.
Rather than this is the most successful political entity in history, and yet the way we look at it is it's luxurious and irrelevant, rather than what has worked. And if you were as a historian and looking at data and evidence, and you were looking at the world over the course of the last 4,000 or 5,000 years since written history has begun, the first question is, who's been successful, right? Which are the great states that have managed to make things work? Where have they been located? What did they do right? And like, you're exactly the right question. When did things go wrong for them? And those start to give you entities that look similar, because a bit like Tolstoy in Anna Karenina, all families are happy in the same way, and all ones that aren't happy fail in their own separate ways and individual ways.
So to what do you subscribe the success and longevity of the Byzantine Empire?
Well, you know, number one, you need to have societies that are literate, that are able to learn and pass knowledge on from one generation to the next. Second, you need to be able to future scope and recognize where your threats are coming from. You need to work out how to neutralize those and to capitalize them. You need to be opportunistic to recognize when there are chances for you. You need to have good public health care. You need to have good sanitation. You need to
understand. Byzantines had good public health care.
Absolutely. I mean, we got all these texts about medical treaties from ancient Greece via Baghdad and via Constantinople back to us in Western Europe. So we think about this as though somehow it was people in the 1500s who solved these riddles. But the smarts, you know, my equivalent 1,000 years ago, Oxford didn't exist as a university. It was at universities in Bukhara, in Samarkand, in Constantinople. These were the places that were the great centers of learning in Cairo. And I think that critical mass is about guaranteeing that you've got food supplies, making sure you've got the minerals, the metals, the resources you need, good training, good civil servants, and above all, the two things you need, an efficient tax collecting system that is honest, and a legal system that delivers justice equally to all people. And that's a real area of concern to all the empires that I look at, is justice available to everybody equally, or only available to the rich? And in all these societies, just like it is in New York or the US, if you can hire a really smart, clever attorney, it costs more, so it's never quite right. So it's, does the judge make a decision based on family connections and on being lent on by the state, or are the judges impartial? And so states that are successful are ones that have an independent judiciary.
Well, I'm speaking out of embarrassing ignorance, but was the Byzantine Empire more than more than merely nominally Christian? Was it suffused throughout with Christian values? Is that part of its success, or was it just nominally Christian?
It's totally Christian. So the Emperor Constantine, after whom the great capital city Constantinople is named, you know, he has a sort of semi-Donald Trump instinct to name things after himself. So the city of Constantine, wait till we get Washington, D.C., the opportunity to rename it as Trumpopolis. But Constantinopolis means the city of Constantine.
Right.
He has this compression point in the beginning of the 300s where there are so many Christians living in the empire. He makes himself the undisputed ruler of the Roman Empire across the whole of the Mediterranean. And he's got a choice, which is either you've got to round up all Christians and kill them, or you've got to open up and become tolerant. And in the story that's told by all of his biographers at the Battle of the Milvian Bridge, he sees a sign in the sky that says, "In Christ's name you shall rule." And so he doesn't only tolerate Christianity. He becomes Christian too. He convenes all the different Christian bishops of different denominations from all over the world, all over the Roman world, brings them to the Council of Nicaea in the year 325. We just passed the 1,700th anniversary. And he says to you, he says to all these priests, look, I don't want to hear too much noise from you guys. Just agree on what you agree on. And he more or less locks them up in a room until they come out with something called the Nicene Creed that is said in churches all around the world every Sunday, most Eucharistic services, where you make a profession of faith that this is what we believe as Christians. That text is agreed and overseen by Constantine. So he opens up the door towards Christianity. Being Byzantine then means being Roman and being Christian. And in fact, the Byzantines, there are lots of language groups within the empire. It changes its borders over time. It contracts, it expands. It can be much bigger than can be smaller, depending on the threats it faces. But Christianity is absolutely central and fundamental to the Byzantine world. But the reason why we are so uncomfortable about it is it creates the challenge of where's the West of Europe when this glorious period is happening? With this 1,000 years of success, of stability, of a functional military, of a shipping fleet that is bringing goods backwards and forwards, that's connecting with China, connecting with Central Asia, connecting with India, connecting with the Indian Ocean, where's France? Where's Spain? Where's England? And the answer is nowhere. So we go Byzantine, it's kind of effeminate. This is a part of the world that doesn't really do anything apart from have nice ceremonials and nice processions. And it gets edited out. And as it happens, the sack of Constantinople, the fall in 1453, is around about the time when Western Europe starts to rise. So Western Europe at that point says, right, let's just skip these last 1,000 years. Let's drop back towards Octavius, Augustus, Julius Caesar, Aristotle, and we're the heirs. And the people who've been that line of continuity, they're the kind of awkward cousins. The less we say about them, the better.
Well, this is, I guess, human nature, right? Because I see this in Protestant circles in which I swim sometimes. They pretend that Christianity began, in 1517, or sometimes they'll think it began at Azusa Street in 1906, which is another subject. But people tend to do that. They tend to say, well, we're going back to the original and we're going to skip over those centuries that are confusing.
But your Protestant friends who talk about 1517 as a start point, you've had Christian communities in China for 1,000 years by that point.
Yeah.
Right? You have St. Thomas visits, goes to set up Christian communities. Yeah. In his lifetime, he's one of the apostles. In the life of Jesus Christ, you have Christians, you have bishops in India and Sri Lanka. So it's news to all these people that somehow Christianity begins in 1517 with Luther, that somehow the fact that a Bible gets translated into a vernacular language, it exists in these other languages all over to the East. But it's uncomfortable for us to think that other people who have different histories are somehow involved in that story.
Well, I would be the last person to say that Christianity began in 1517, having written a biography of Luther. So more in agreement with you by far on that. In the interest of time, let me ask you, are you an optimist about where we're headed? The centuries of the rise and collapse of these empires that you've written about and studied. From where we stand now, are you optimistic, generally?
Yes. Three reasons. Number one, while we're recording this, any child born anywhere on this planet is going to have the longest life expectancy of any child ever born, right? And that is a combination of human ingenuity, kindness, investment in medical healthcare, and is a testimony to our compassion to look after everybody on this planet. So I'm optimistic because...
Is compassion self-interest?
I don't have the skills to be able to evaluate
I think you do. I think you know the answer is no.
But as a Christian myself, I believe absolutely in the beauty of compassion and the dignity of humanity, of wanting people to be, in the words of Thomas Jefferson, free and happy. And I think that no one can phrase that ever better than Jefferson does in the Declaration of Independence. You know, about not just equality, but life, liberty, and happiness. That is why America is great. That is why our human societies is great. That is why the United States is the paragon, because no matter what country you're born in on earth, those are the three things everybody wants. And if that's what the United States is selling, everyone's a buyer. So I'm optimistic for that reason. I'm optimistic because necessity is the mother of all invention. And in an age where we're going into a major climatic reorganization of warming, for all sorts of reasons, new digital technologies that present us with questions that are extremely difficult to work out even what the questions are, let alone what the answers might be. we've got to work out how do we think. And these are all global questions that we're going to need to work out how we solve at scale rather than two people sitting in a room working out themselves. And I think you've got to take a bet on whether you think humans are able to solve problems or they're not. And despite the warnings of Adam and Eve and how we can be the architects of our own downfall, you've got to think that we can learn from these lessons from the past. So there's a long tradition of people promising the apocalypse. It's very important in Christianity. It's very important in Judaism. Very prominent. Very important in Islam. It's very in the Buddhist tradition. You know, everything dies. So don't enjoy anything. You're dead. Think about what's coming in the next life. If you're a plant, if you're a bug, if you're a human, don't enjoy anything because this is all transitory. Your emotions.
Just to be clear, I'm not a plant. But go ahead. Yes.
But all these things, think about what the doom and the darkness that's coming. Mm. So I think we should be focusing on how do we cooperate? How do we work together? How do we find ways of encouraging each other to make better decisions? And it won't surprise you to know that as a professor, as an academic, and as an educator, that starts by the imparting of knowledge. And the better you can do that, the better you can talk about inclusivity, the better you can talk about how peoples have worked together, how you can learn from important episodes from the past, probably the better chances you have of using history as a toolbox to see how other people have solve problems either well or less well. And I guess, like I would tell my students, and like my wife tells me, take the good option rather than the bad option. And the palettes of history that I'm working on are so rich with detail, so untouched by most scholarship, that it's quite helpful to see a wider set of examples than perhaps we normally see.
And thanks to you in writing your book, The Silk Roads, A New History of the World, many of us can do that. Very grateful to you, Peter Frankopan, not just for writing these books, but for your hour with us. Thank you so much.
It's a pleasure. Thank you.
If you think these conversations are valuable, would you do us a favor and please like this video and subscribe to this channel? When you do that, you help us get these conversations out to a wider audience by telling YouTube that people are interested in this. Also, you can go to SocratesInTheCity.com, sign up for our newsletter, and you can check back every week. There's new stuff here every week. Thank you for tuning in.